Wind ripples the surface of Lake Mose. Along the lake bed, a current invisibly sweeps over brittle slabs of stone towards a concrete dam. A gentle swish grows to a roar as the water funnels into the black opening of a tunnel cut through rock, surges into 11 steel pipes, and rushes 1,000 feet down a steep slope towards a hulking, stone-clad structure on the edge of a cliff. The building, 8 stories tall with towers rising to cupolas, vibrates like a beehive in winter. Most of the water rushes onwards to a series of turbine generators, but some of it is diverted off into a plant where chemicals are manufactured for the production of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. The lake water combines with potash lye to improve its conductivity and flows into a grid of 1,824 electrolysis cells. There, it is zapped with electricity, breaking apart some of the water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen. The remaining water plunges down a level into a smaller grid of cells, is zapped again, breaking down further. The remainder pours into yet a smaller grid, down and down, until just 3 cells remain. This leftover liquid is about 10% heavy water, a form of water containing a rare isotope of hydrogen and a necessary component for Werner Heisenberg's nuclear reactor experiments. The water now flows into the plant's basement, where it pools within 2 final rows of stainless steel electrolysis cells, zapping, diluting, zapping, diluting, zapping, diluting, until at the end of the line, 1 drop at a time, emerges 99.5% pure, heavy water, a perfect neutron moderator, a step in the direction of the atomic bomb. Drip, drip, drip. Raindrops clung to the foggy windows of the flat at 64 Baker Street in London. The Norwegian section chief of the British Special Operations Executive briefed 2 commandos on a secret mission. Working with a team from British Combined Operations, they would sabotage a Nazi heavy water manufacturing facility at the Norsk Hydro-Vemork power plant near the town of Rjukan in Norway, where both men had grown up. The SOE commander wanted to make sure they understood the stakes. If they failed, he said, the Nazis would have the necessary resources to build a weapon that could destroy London in 1 fell swoop. Jens Anton Paulsen tapped a foot impatiently. Knut Howland frowned, bemused. The 2 Norwegian resistance fighters assumed their commander was exaggerating. He was not. I'm Jake Barton, welcome to Historium. This is Atomic Dawn, Chapter 3, Heavy Water. In late 1939 in Germany, the Nazis gathered their leading physicists to discuss a paper written by Danish physicist Niels Bohr. In it, Bohr described 2 isotopes of uranium, U-238, which is relatively common, and U-235, which is incredibly rare. The latter, U-235, was inherently more conducive to fission, thus necessary for an atomic bomb. But Bohr argued this isotope was so difficult to separate from a mass of uranium that it was basically impossible. Remember Bohr's comment to Edward Teller that making an atomic bomb can never be done unless you turn the United States into 1 huge factory? This is what he was talking about. Heisenberg proposed an alternative. U-238, the most common isotope of uranium, could also be coaxed into a nuclear chain reaction if it were dispersed within a moderating substance. The only moderator that could theoretically work, he argued, was heavy water. The Germans could start by building a nuclear reactor with U-238 and heavy water, at the very least using it to generate power, and then explore possibilities for developing the reactor into some sort of weapon. It was not a very good plan, but it was a start. If Heisenberg was going to get heavy water, though, he'd have to look outside Germany. Powering a plant would have required far more coal than the Reich could spare. There was only 1 factory in the world that could manufacture heavy water at scale, a Norsk Hydro synthetic fertilizer factory and hydroelectric power plant at Rjukan in Norway. IG Farben, the powerful German chemical cartel that was one of Hitler's biggest funders, owned Norsk Hydro stock and offered to be the go-between. When IG Farben representatives showed up in Rjukan and offered to buy all the plant's current stock of heavy water and 10 times its current level of production going forward, the Norwegian general manager was wary. As far as he knew, heavy water was a more or less useless byproduct of the hydrolysis process. Was he missing something? When the Nazis refused to reveal why they wanted the heavy water, the skeptical Norwegian turned down their offer, generous as it was. He was happy he had done so when, shortly thereafter, he received a message from a French bank that was a majority shareholder in Norsk Hydro. The French Minister of Armament had warned the bank what heavy water could be used for. Keeping it out of the hands of the Nazis was critical. Norsk Hydro immediately orchestrated the shipment of its entire supply of heavy water to the French, refusing payment. Norsk Hydro workers filled 26 aluminum canisters designed to be hidden inside suitcases, drove them down the winding roads to Oslo, and loaded them onto two planes. They pretended to load a third plane as well, a decoy to draw the attention of German pilots. It was a shell game. All three planes took off, heading for Edinburgh. Sure enough, Luftwaffe fighter planes were soon hot on their tails, and they forced one of the planes down in Hamburg. It was empty. The heavy water was safely out of German reach. In April 1940, however, the Nazis invaded Norway. The Norwegian resistance around Ryuken was fierce, but eventually the Nazis prevailed, securing access to the Norsk Hydro Vemork plant. They now controlled the only factory in the world producing heavy water. When Niels Bohr, Denmark's greatest physicist, escaped the Nazis and made it to London, a recent conversation weighed heavy on his mind. Not long before, he had met with his old protege, Werner Heisenberg, who is now head of the Nazi nuclear project. Without explanation, Heisenberg had given Bohr a drawing, a sketch of a rudimentary nuclear reactor. Bohr showed Heisenberg's drawing to a director of the British nuclear bomb project, who supported Bohr's intel with reports from the Norwegian underground that the Nazis had ramped up heavy water production tenfold. The Nazis were up to something. The director passed along the information to Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who discussed the situation with American President Franklin Roosevelt. Churchill later wrote, quote, "We knew what efforts the Germans were making to procure supplies of heavy water, a sinister term, eerie, unnatural, which began to creep into our secret papers. What if the enemy should get the atomic bomb before we did? We could not run the mortal risk of being outstripped in this awful sphere," unquote. In the United States, the head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development and a key organizer of the Manhattan Project wrote, quote, "The threat of German fission bombs is even more imminent than we supposed. If the Germans know what we know, and we dare not discount their knowledge, they should be dropping fission bombs on us in 1943, a year before our bombs are planned to be ready," unquote. General Leslie Groves, the military director of the Manhattan Project, requested British action against the Vemork plant. The British Army was already prepared with a crack team of 30 specially trained sappers, Royal Engineers. The team knew the layout of the Vemork plant inside and out. They'd studied blueprints. They'd run practice missions on an exact replica of the high concentration cells. This was all possible because the British had a secret weapon. The man who had designed the plant itself, Professor Leif Tronstad, had fled Norway and was working for the British, overseeing intelligence and sabotage for the Norwegian government in exile in London. He knew the factory's layout backwards and forwards. It was he who talked the British out of an air attack on the plant. The heavy water facility was located deep in the basement where it was unlikely to be damaged, and further, an explosion among the plant's liquid ammonia tanks would be deadly for the Norwegian workers who lived in the company town of Ryuken near the plant. Instead, the British would send in a team on the ground. In order to ensure the operation was successful, they needed a four-man advance team familiar with the territory to scout ahead and guide the demolition experts. The reconnaissance mission was called Operation Grouse. Jens Anton Paulsen would lead the team. He had grown up in Ryuken. His father was an engineer at Norsk Hydro. He had curly blonde hair, was equal parts bookworm and outdoorsman, an excellent skier, fisherman, and hunter. He had escaped Norway and traveled around the world in his journey to join the SOE's Norwegian Independent Company 1. He selected the following men to accompany him on his mission. All had undergone extensive special ops training with the Norwegian Army in Scotland. Arne Kjellstrup had trekked out of Norway with Paulsen, A short king with a sturdy build, he was a former plumber who had fought the Nazis in the invasion and now had a bullet permanently lodged in his hip. Knut Howland was boyish and clever with a charming smirk. He was the son of a Ryukin carpenter and a skilled radio operator. And finally, Knut Haukelid, who was the brother of Hollywood movie star Sigrid Guri. A cool and calculating loner, he was eager to fight the Nazis. To his dismay, before he could be deployed, he accidentally shot himself in the foot during a training exercise. Try as he might to convince his doctors he'd be back on his feet in no time, they refused to mark him fit for duty. But don't worry, Knut Haukelid will return. For now, his replacement was Klaus Helberg, an old friend of Paulson's and a masterful mountain guide, who was tall, wiry, and up for anything. The four men's mission was to drop via parachute into the marshes on the Hardanger Plateau, 10 miles to the north of the Vemork plant. They would rendezvous with a member of the underground, seek a suitable landing area for the Horsa gliders that would bring in the British sappers, choose the best route to the target, direct the incoming aircraft when they arrived, and guide a team of British sappers to the plant for the sabotage mission. They didn't know the extent to which their lives were at stake. Hitler had issued a secret order. Any enemy commandos captured in Norway were to be slaughtered, even if they tried to surrender. On October 18, 1942, 24 minutes to midnight, Operation Grouse began. Paulson hung for a moment in freefall, the sound of the plane's whirring propellers fading away into a distant hum. He breathed deep of the fresh air that buffeted his face, then yanked the ripcord. A swoosh as the parachute slithered out of its pack, a jolt as the chute opened. Above him, somewhere in the blue dark, Kjellstrup, Howland, and Helberg opened their own chutes, descending like jellyfish through the star-spattered night. Hanging over the familiar peaks and valleys of his homeland, Paulson felt a surge of nostalgia. The men couldn't see the marshes where they intended to land, and instead came down deep in the mountain forest. Finding each other, they rounded up the packages of gear they had dropped from the plane. Tents, stove, sleeping bags, rabbit fur-lined long underwear, gabardine pants, windproof coats, balaclavas, goggles, food, tobacco. Paulson lit up his pipe and unfolded a map. He soon realized that the Grouse team had a situation on their hands. They hadn't landed far from the marshes as the crow flies, but the shortest route over the mountains was too exposed to the elements, especially given their limited supply of kerosene for the stove. Instead, they would have to trek down through the valley and go around the long way, which meant they were actually 45 miles from their intended destination. To make matters worse, the radio the British had sent them didn't have a functional antenna. They had no way of coordinating with the incoming glider teams. They would have to make for the rendezvous point and hope for the best. The attack on Vemork was scheduled for the next month's new moon, 4 weeks from now. They waxed their skis, hefted their 70-pound packs onto their backs, and set out, slogging over the fresh snow. It was agonizingly slow going. Burdened down by their gear, the men became mired in snowdrifts. At the shore of a wide lake, they decided to cross on the ice. It was treacherous, but it dramatically shortened the distance to the marshes. Paulson went first, easing out onto the flat expanse. When he heard the sharp crack of the breaking ice, it was already too late. He fell into the frigid water. He surfaced, fighting to make his lungs expand. Every muscle tightened against the cold. With his soaked mittens, he grasped at the rim of the ice around him, but only managed to break off flakes of ice that bobbed in the water. Kjellstrup ran out as close as he dared, then eased down onto his belly and extended a ski pole in Paulson's direction. Slowly, he pulled the team leader out of the water and across the ice. On shore, Paulson stripped down and warmed himself by a fire. They wouldn't be taking any more shortcuts. The men found a farmhouse, seemingly abandoned, where they took shelter and ate their fill of the frozen meat they found within, boiling it in a pot of water over a warm fire. They continued this pattern, breaking into cabins and hunters' huts for shelter whenever they could, sleeping in tents when there was no other option. Their skin grew dry, and their chapped lips peeled. Their beards grew out, their muscles became taut and wiry. They subsisted on reindeer meat whenever they could hunt, drinking the steaming blood of a fresh kill from 10 cups, frying up the meat and organs, boiling the bones, and semi-digested stomach contents into a gelatinous slurry. Their boots began to deteriorate. a faulty battery for the non-functional radio leaked corrosive acid into their packs. They were always wet. There was no way they could communicate with the agent of the Norwegian underground who had planned to meet them near Lake Langeja. There was no guarantee he would still be there when they arrived. Back in London, 2 weeks passed and Tronstad heard no word from the Grouse team. Still, the 30 sappers from the Royal Engineer Unit of the British Army drilled day in, day out, preparing for their mission, Operation Freshman. They would enter the Norwegian airspace in two wooden Horsa Mark I gliders towed behind Halifax bombers. The gliders were silent as death itself, minimizing the risk of detection. With help from the Norwegian advance party, Lord willing, they would land the gliders, ride bicycles down the road to the heavy water plant, force their way in, and destroy it. On November 9th, a message arrived from the Norwegian team. Tronstad held his breath as he read, quote, "Happy landing in spite of stones everywhere. Sorry to keep you waiting. Snowstorm and fog forced us to go down valleys. 4 feet of snow, impossible with heavy equipment to cross mountains. Had to hurry on for reaching target area in time." Unquote. A flurry of further messages followed. The Grouse team had made it to the rendezvous point and met up with their contact. Howland had jerry-rigged the radio to work with a makeshift antenna made of fishing poles and a new battery supplied by the underground. Operation Freshman was a go. The 30 Royal Engineers crossed the tarmac in the misty Highland rain and boarded the two Horsa gliders. Each was attached to a bomber by a 350-foot-long rope. The planes, Halifax A and Halifax B, fired up their engines, accelerated down the runway, and lifted off into the night. On a hillside above the marsh, Howland and Kjellstrup watched the sky with red flashlights at the ready to signal to the incoming gliders. Down on the marsh, Paulsen and Helberg prepared the landing zone. Dense clouds swept by overhead. A tone sounded on Howland's headset. The planes were incoming. He and Kjellstrup switched on the lights. The sound of engines swelled, then faded. The men couldn't see through the layer of clouds. They strained for glimpses of the gliders. Nothing. Another tone on Howland's headset followed by the sound of another engine, a faint hum at first, growing to a roar. Again, decrescendo to silence. No glider in sight. At 9,000 feet, Halifax A was suffocated in fog. The pilot nosed up another 3,000 feet to get above the clouds, breaking out momentarily into an endless starscape. The engine strained audibly. The plane, towing the glider, couldn't sustain that altitude, and the pilot was forced to descend once again into blindness. Behind him, the glider bounced about like a piñata at the end of a rope, tossed by gusts of wind, sappers hurled against their seatbelts. Ice encrusted the plane's wings and propeller blades, breaking off and slamming into the fuselage with a rattle that sounded like gunfire. The pilot took the plane lower to clear the ice, but now the fog was even thicker. The wind battered the plane and viciously yanked the glider every which way until, snap, the rope broke. The plane vanished instantly into the fog, the sound of its engine soon muffled by clouds. The glider lifted off to the side and dropped into a spin. The sappers linked arms to brace for a crash landing, hurtling downward, tossed by the wind, visibility zero, until, a flash of clarity, the snow-blanketed face of a mountain. The glider crashed. Its glass nose, which housed the pilots, shattered. Shards of splintered wood hurtled through the air as its wings and plywood shell were pulverized. The pilots and 6 sappers died then and there. 9 sappers survived, but for the most part, they were so badly injured that they could barely crawl from the wreckage. Halifax B also failed to locate the beacon. They circled back, looking for the red lights in the dark, but seeing nothing. With their fuel reserves dwindling, they gave up and set out to return to Scotland while they still could. But as with the first plane, they too became mired in fog. Ice coated the wings, propellers, and tow rope, which snapped. The glider slowed while the plane buzzed off ahead. The pilot, anxious to find the glider, dipped down and circled back over the valley, in and out of low-hanging clouds, catching glimpses of the landscape below, but no sign of the glider. Another fog bank, another moment of clear skies, then dead ahead of them, the side of a mountain. The pilot pushed the throttle as far back as it would go. The engines groaned, rivets creaked. The plane climbed as it hurtled towards the peak, but not fast enough. The underbelly and tail of the plane dragged over the mountain's rocky crest. The tail gunner was tossed from his turret as the plane careened over the peak and skidded across the high plateau beyond, slamming into jagged boulders that ripped metal into ribbons. The torn edges of the tarnished steel gleamed in firelight. Flaming puddles of fuel sizzled as they ran together with pools of blood. Every man on board was killed in the crash. The two pilots in the second glider maneuvered their craft masterfully through the fog, descending, descending. The only real sense of motion was that sinking feeling in the pits of their stomach as they lost altitude. They were trapped in maddening visual and aural stasis. Through the glass, a blank field of unchanging gray. Beneath the eerie creaking of timbers, a vast silence. They were a ship becalmed at sea. Until they saw treetops below them, around them, brushing the underside of the plane, catching the wings. The wooden craft cracked and wobbled, jolted with every collision until it slammed into the gradual mountain slope in a spray of snow and gravel and pine branches. The two pilots, exposed in the glass bubble of the glider's nose, were killed on impact, as was one of the sappers, but every other man survived. They sought help in a nearby town, realizing that their only hope of survival was to surrender to the Nazis. When a German lieutenant arrived on the scene, he promised they would be treated as prisoners of war. The Nazis loaded the Royal Engineers into trucks and took them to another town, where over the course of an hour, they were interrogated. Afterward, in accordance with Hitler's secret order, every last man was shot. The survivors from the first glider were also eventually found, interrogated, and killed. And among their gear, the Nazis found a map that outlined their target, the Vemork Heavy Water Plant. Back in Scotland, Halifax A returned unscathed, but with disquieting news about the loss of their glider. The next day, the Grouse team reported that neither glider team had appeared. Operation Freshman had failed. The chief of combined operations wrote to Churchill to inform him of the disaster. Churchill replied with the following message. Quote, alas, unquote. The four Norwegian commandos waited in a cabin near Lake Langeja, slurping bowls of boiled moss and sucking the marrow from reindeer bones. A message came through. Howland decoded it. Quote, sabotage troops were engaged and annihilated. It is vitally necessary that you should preserve your safety. Advise you move yourself and your station. Keep up your heart. We will do this job yet. Unquote. It was time to get serious. Oversight of operations against the Vemork plant was handed to the British Special Operations Executive, known as the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. The SOE had been organized on Churchill's watch to orchestrate guerrilla warfare operations within enemy territory and destabilize adversaries using sabotage, labor agitation, propaganda, terrorism, protests, and riots. The SOE leadership knew they could handle this mission with a lean, highly trained team of Norwegian special ops commandos who would join forces with Poulsen, Kjellstrup, Howland, and Helberg. It would be dangerous. The Nazis now knew that the raid was coming and had added more guards, searchlights, and a machine gun nest overlooking the Vemork factory grounds. But the SOE knew someone they could rely on for just such an occasion. Second Lieutenant Joachim Roenberg of the SOE arrived at Chiltern Court to learn the details of the secret mission to which he had been assigned. There, the Norwegian met with Tronstad, who informed him of his target, Vemork. Roenberg would recruit five men to accompany him. His second in command would be Knut Hauglid. Remember him? The guy who shot himself in the foot training for Operation Grouse? Yeah, he's back and ready for action. Rounding out the team were Birger Stromsheim, a building contractor who, according to his SOE file, was reliable as a rock. Frederick Kayser, a Renaissance man and former clerk at an ironworks. Kasper Idlund, a mailman and gentle giant. And Hans Storhaug, a first-rate outdoorsman who is nicknamed Chicken due to his short stature, big feet, and big nose. Tronstad walked the men through the Vemork plan's blueprints, pointing out a barely visible cable intake tunnel that led down into the basement. It was just big enough for a man to crawl through. Using the same wooden replica of the heavy water facility, the team trained for the sabotage operation. Step 1, descend into the basement and neutralize any guards. Step 2, identify the two rows of 9 heavy concentration cells. Step 3, using Nobel 808, a reddish plastic explosive that smelled a bit like almonds, affix a charge to each tank, ensuring that it was properly linked to a detonator cord. For now, the men practiced with modeling clay. Step 4, attach the initiator to the cord to the detonator and light the pencil time fuse. Step 5, get the hell out of there. They drilled until they could do it blindfolded, and then they drilled some more. The mission was planned for Christmas Eve 1942, but due to bad weather and false starts, it got pushed back again and again. It wasn't until February 16th, 1943, that the planes finally got in the air. No gliders this time. They would paradrop in about a day's walk from base camp. Operation Gunnerside was underway. Over Bjornfjord in Norway, Ronberg, Haukelid, and their 4 comrades stepped out through the plane's open bay and fell into the night. Their parachutes carried them, gracefully, down into a wide open valley. They gathered their scattered gear. Around dawn, they broke into a cabin where they slept for most of the day. The next day, a blizzard descended on the valley, forcing the men to hole up in the cabin. The wind picked up, nearly tearing the building apart. All 6 men were born and raised in this neck of the woods, yet this was the most intense storm any of them had ever experienced. For days, the storm raged on. The cabin walls became fuzzy with mold-like hoarfrost. The men fell ill and feverish. When the storm finally passed, the commandos, weakened and aching, burst out through the drifts piled over the cabin and tried to get their bearings in the snow-covered landscape. They prepared to depart when they spotted a man pulling a sled. The 6 men trained their guns on the man, who claimed to be a hunter. His sled was loaded with reindeer meat. Serendipity. They ate. When they were finished, they demanded the man lead them in the direction of the rendezvous point. After skiing for miles, the team emerged into a valley and looked out over a frozen lake. There, below them, were 2 skiers crossing the valley, coming their direction. The men quickly ducked out of sight. Haukelid crept closer to get a better look, keeping low until he could see their faces. The men were haggard, with long, greasy beards, and they were bundled in many layers of clothing, but he recognized them instantly. It was Helberg and Kjellstrup, the men he had trained with for months. He stood up and whooped in greeting. The 2 men turned, startled, then recognized him. They rushed over and embraced. That night, the 10 commandos feasted together on crackers, chocolate, raisins, and, less excitingly, more reindeer meat. They smoked cigarettes, savoring every puff. The next morning, over a breakfast of rejuvenating coffee and more reindeer meat, the men prepared for the task at hand. Ronberg, Kayser, Stromsheim, and Idlund would handle the explosives. Poulsen, Helberg, Kjellstrup, Storhaug, aka Chicken, and Haukelid, our somewhat clumsy friend, would cover them. Howland would stay behind with the radio. The team would bypass the guarded suspension bridge by crossing the frozen river well upstream and ascending the far side of the gorge to a railway track. This track ran along the top of a perilous cliff above the river. From the railroad, the commandos would cross a field peppered with mines on their way up to a gate into the Vemork plant. The gate was locked and patrolled, but unlike the suspension bridge, it didn't have a permanent guard. There were 15 guards active at any given time, 3 of those guards preoccupied on the bridge. They would wait for a moment when the coast was clear, then make their move. If the saboteurs were detected and the alarm sounded, the floodlights would be fired up and the soldiers in the barracks of Vemork itself and the town of Ryukin would be summoned, and the saboteurs would soon be dead. Nightfall, February 27, 1943. The men dressed in silence, white camouflage over British Army uniforms. If they were caught and seen as Brits rather than Norwegians, the German reprisals on nearby towns might be less severe. Every man had a pistol, a killing knife, chloroform pads, hand grenades, and as much extra ammunition as he could reasonably carry. There would be 2 parties, One group would take the explosives and arm the detonators. The second group would keep watch, covering the saboteurs with Tommy guns they had painted white. Paulson placed a bottle of whiskey on the table. They would drink a celebratory toast upon their return. But every man knew, deep down, no matter what he told himself, that he wouldn't be returning. This was a suicide mission. Each man double-checked to make sure he had his cyanide pill. They skied at first, then when the terrain became more difficult, proceeded on foot, wading through waist-high snowdrifts, steadying themselves on tree branches. A buzzing hum grew louder, the sound of the Vemork power plant. They pressed on through the dense woods, then all at once stepped out past the tree line onto the edge of the gorge and saw their target. The hydrogen production plant rose on a cliff over the Mana River, a concrete fortress that towered against a scrim of fast-blowing clouds, backlit by stars. The wind whipped at the drawstrings of the men's hoods, tugged at the white cloth covering their backpacks. They heard the whirring of engines, then saw headlights on the road below. Dropping to the snow, they hid on the slope as two buses full of night shift workers passed. Then, when the coast was clear, they slipped down into the gorge, stripping off their white camouflage once they entered the shadows. They crossed the treacherous frozen river without incident, then craned their necks to look up at the 600-foot cliff they would have to scale to reach the railroad track at the top of the gorge. They looked to Roenberg, who nodded, tightened the straps of his pack, and began the ascent. One by one, foothold by foothold, they made their way up the cliff, slipping on ice as the wind intensified, clinging to roots for dear life, shimmying across narrow ledges. For over an hour they climbed, finally reaching the top around 11 p.m. From there, the team crept along the tracks towards the plant. The thrumming of the turbine generators grew louder. Clouds covered the moon. At 11:40, they reached their target. The power station and hydrogen plant loomed dark in the frigid night, every window blacked out to make the site invisible from the air. The commandos ducked behind a transformer shed to wait for the midnight changing of the guard. They rested, one man always keeping eyes on the bridge across the gorge. Right on time, the replacements walked out across the bridge to relieve the sleepy guards, who retired to their barracks. Time to move. The team set out in single file across the minefield leading up to the gate, cover party first, followed by the demolition party. The gate was unguarded. Kjellstrup cut the lock with bolt cutters and motioned his compatriots through. At the foot of the seven-story plant, they split up. Roenberg, Kayser, Stromsheim, and Idlund headed for the cable intake tunnel that led into the heavy water concentration facility. Hawklid, Paulson, Helberg, Kjellstrup, and Storhaug dropped back into the shadows, readied their Tommy guns, and waited, alert to every sound, every flicker of light. Kayser and Stromsheim found a steel ladder that descended into the tunnel. They dug through the snow-choked entrance and peered inside. Water pipes and cables ran along the tunnel, vanishing into darkness within. The two men dropped to their hands and knees and slid inside, dragging their packs of explosives behind them. When they looked back, Stromsheim and Idlund hadn't followed, so they pressed on, just the two of them. Crawling in such cramped quarters was agonizingly slow, but up ahead, they saw light. The tunnel opened out below them into a long hallway. Roenberg held on to a pipe, eased his legs through the opening, dangled for a moment, and then let go, falling 15 feet and hitting the ground in a perfect drop and roll. Kayser passed down the packs of explosives, then followed. Through a window in a pair of doors, they could see the 18 stainless steel high concentration cells, each 4 feet tall and 10 inches wide. A night shift worker sat at a desk. Roenberg and Kayser readied their pistols, took a breath, then kicked open the doors, guns aimed at the worker. The man froze and raised his hands. While Kayser guarded the worker, Roenberg rigged the plastic explosives, affixing one to each tank, slowly, methodically, just like he had practiced hundreds of times. He froze at the sound of scuffling outside the door leading out to the yard. Glass shattered. Roenberg looked to Kayser, who raised his gun. An arm reached through the door's broken window, grasped the handle, and opened the door. Two men entered. It was Stromsheim and Idlund. Relieved, Kayser lowered his weapon and invited Idlund to help him keep watch. Roenberg got back to work with Stromsheim's assistants. Once all the charges were attached to the tanks, they linked them together with cable, then attached the fuses. Footsteps in the hall. The night foreman. He entered to find himself staring down the barrels of two pistols. They ordered him and the other night shift worker out into the hall and up the stairs, told them to lie down on the ground, cover their ears, and hold still until they heard a bang. Roenberg reached in his pocket, pulled out a British parachute badge, and dropped it on the floor. Again, it was best if the Nazis believed this was a British-only operation. He and Stromsheim lit the fuses. The four men walked quickly to the basement door, checked outside for guards, then ran like hell. A dampened, rumbling boom behind them, a chime of shattered glass. For a moment, their shadows were cast in sharp contrast ahead of them. The orange light of flames surged, then died down to darkness. They made it out of the building, across the open yard, and behind cover, then headed for the escape route. Haukelid and Paulsen, meanwhile, crouched behind storage tanks watching the barracks. They saw the door open. A single guard emerged and paused, listening. He walked towards the hydrogen plant, stared up at it a moment, then returned to the barracks. Haukelid and Paulsen looked at each other and breathed a sigh of relief. But the barracks door opened again, and the guard reemerged, now wearing a helmet and carrying a rifle with a flashlight. He walked to their direction, his beam of light sweeping ever closer to where the two men hid. Closer, closer. They held their breath. The guard paused. He turned and surveyed the grounds once more. Seemingly satisfied, he returned to the barracks. The two Norwegians remained motionless until they heard the door latch. Then, keeping low, they made their way for the exit. There they found Kjellstrup and Helberg, who told them that Kayser, Roenberg, Stromsheim, Idlund, and Storhaug had already made it out. The four men snuck out the gate and soon caught up with the rest of the team, but they hadn't progressed far along the railroad tracks before they heard sirens and saw the plant illuminated by floodlights. Flashlights appeared in the gateway behind them. They were pursued. They ran. At the cliff, they slipped and scrambled, here and there losing a grip, falling, thinking it was all over, only to land on a ledge or catch a shelf. They made it to the bottom, all of them. No sign of their pursuers. So they trod gingerly back over the icy river, dashed across the open road, climbed the embankment, and, reattaching their skis, they trekked through the woods. The moisture from their breath, visible in the cold, blew back into their faces, covering their eyelashes in delicate ice crystals. The sun rose, the sky turned a brilliant pink. At the cabin, the nine Norwegians toasted their success with shots of whiskey. In London, Tronstad waited. Finally, a message came through from the Norwegian team. It read, quote, "Operation carried out with 100% success. High concentration plant completely destroyed," unquote. Nearly half a ton of heavy water had been lost, setting the Nazis back at least 6 months. Tronstad began cooking up another plan to sabotage the next batch of heavy water. He would use his inside man to contaminate the cells with castor oil and make the product unusable. Before he could set his plan in motion, however, an American air raid devastated the area surrounding Vemork. The attack was approved despite the risk to Norwegian civilians and in violation of an agreement with the Norwegian army in exile. It did no further damage to the actual high concentration plant, but it did serve to devastate the region and terrorize the local populace. Norsk Hydro announced it would shut down operations at the Vemork plant, and the Nazis prepared to move the heavy water manufacturing machinery to a new secret location. The Germans' only source of heavy water, once a sitting duck for Tronstad's saboteurs, was about to slip through the Allies' grasp. Tronstad knew he had to act fast. He called upon Knut Haukelid. Haukelid had stayed behind in Norway to organize the underground resistance. It was a gut-wrenching sacrifice. Suspecting Haukelid's involvement in the underground, the Nazis had dragged his mother in for questioning, had imprisoned and tortured his father, neither of whom had any idea what their son was really doing. But Haukelid knew what he was doing, and he knew that it was necessary. Tronstad's inside man had told him that the Nazis were preparing to ship all of the remaining heavy water stock, whether it was fully concentrated or not, out of the country in 40 iron drums. Someone had to stop them. It wasn't long before Hauklid received instructions from Tronstad, quote, "The demolition or perforation of the drums, especially drums containing high concentrations, is of greatest importance. Leave British effects where the action takes place, and if possible, use uniforms as before. Try to make the action to cause the least harm to the civil populations," unquote. The heavy water shipment would travel by train, then ferry across Lake Tinsu, then train to the port of Menstad, where it would be shipped to Germany. The weakest link in this chain was the ferry. If Hauklid could sink it, the drums of heavy water would be inaccessible at the bottom of the lake, which happened to be one of the deepest in Europe. Hauklid's best option was to sneak on board the night before the ferry's scheduled departure, rig up a timed explosive, then sneak away and make a break for the Swedish border. Before he could finalize his plans, however, Hauklid had to case the joint. He headed into Ryukin. An orchestra was in town, touring with a locally famous composer and violinist. To blend in, Hauklid carried his Sten gun in a violin case down the main street. Nazis were everywhere, smoking under bakery awnings, laughing in cafes, stopping traffic to ask for IDs, queuing up for the concert. Hauklid took the train down to Lake Tinsu, where the ferry and the SF Hydro bounced on the lake's gentle swells. It was designed to ship loads of fertilizer and potassium nitrate. Its deck was outfitted with tracks for freight cars to roll right on board. Hauklid bought a ticket and walked up the gangplank onto the ferry. He timed the loading of rail cars and boarding of passengers, timed the ferry's departure, timed how long it took to get to the deepest part of the lake. He made small talk with the helmsman. He smoked a pipe with the chief engineer as he scoped out the engine room. After the 4-hour trip across the lake and back, the ferry dock and Hauklid took the train back to Ryukin. There, Hauklid assembled a small team from members of the underground. He collected explosives, enlisting the help of a local Norsk Hydro pensioner and a watch repairman to build a detonator. The old tinkerer presented Hauklid with a pair of alarm clocks, modified to close a circuit and light the bomb's fuses at a preset time. In a small cabin near Ryukin, Hauklid finalized his plans with two men he chose to accompany him. They calculated how much Nobel 808 they would need. Ideally, they would blow an 11-foot-wide hole in the ferry's bow, sinking the boat in approximately 4 minutes, hopefully long enough for the passengers to board lifeboats. Rumors of impending sabotage had made their way to the military leaders in Berlin, who dispatched the elite 7th SS Police Regiment to guard the heavy water train transport. Heinrich Himmler, Hitler's right-hand man, himself sent two Fieseler Storch airplanes to guard the train from above. Nazi soldiers drilled on a plateau within earshot of Hauklid's cabin. In town, Gestapo agents patrolled the streets. But the thing that kept Hauklid up at night wasn't the intermittent rifle fire or the wind howling in the chimney. It was the knowledge that there would be civilians on that ferry. Norwegian passengers. The captain. Crew. People he had met. People who would likely die. He knew the stakes. He had his orders. He was prepared to live out the rest of his life, cursed with the memory of what he had done. He just hoped that, in the moment, he would have the nerve to see the mission through. In the starlit pre-dawn, Hauklid sat in the idling car. The second of his two accomplices opened the back door and shoved in a suitcase full of valuables he would carry with him when he fled the country. He eased into the seat and closed the door. Hauklid drove down the road towards the lake. The saboteur who had just joined them said he had come from a dinner party. While there, to his surprise, he had met the violinist who was in town performing with the orchestra. In passing, the violinist mentioned he was planning to leave the following morning on the ferry. Without revealing his plans, the saboteur had done everything he could to convince the violinist to stay just one more night. He assured the man he hadn't fully experienced all that Ryukin had to offer, and advised him to stay through the weekend and ski. But the violinist was committed to leaving on the morning ferry. Hauklid listened in silence, the feeling of dread ever growing. He had 19 pounds of explosives wrapped around his body under his parka, and two alarm clocks bulging in his pockets. A mile out from the docks, they parked the car, and Hauklid and his two accomplices crept down to the shore, keeping low. Below them, the Hydra was a black blot on a field of reflected stars. The saboteurs boarded the ferry. They crept past the door to the crew's quarters. It hung ajar, and a bar of light cut across the hall. Within, they could hear the murmur of the crew playing cards. Halkalid led the team into the passenger compartment towards a passageway below decks, but the three men froze when they heard footsteps. "Who goes there?" came the voice of a night watchman. All the saboteurs turned, slowly. The watchman recognized one of Halkalid's team. A man he knew was part of the resistance, but he asked what they were doing here at this time of night. On the spot, the man invented a story. He told the watchman they were hiding something sensitive from the Nazis. They expected a raid and needed an unlikely place to stash their contraband. Eager to be of service, the watchman pointed the saboteurs to the hatch leading below deck. Leaving one saboteur behind to chat with the guard, Halkalid and the other saboteur descended into the bilge and crawled through a foot of freezing water to the bow, flashlights clenched between their teeth. Halkalid rigged the explosives. The familiar almond smell of Nobel 808 washed over him. Hands trembling, he attached the clocks to two detonator caps and set the alarms for 10:45 a.m. Returning back to the deck, Halkalid thanked the night guard for his service to his country and shook his hand. Disembarking from the ferry, Halkalid and his friends returned to their getaway car and drove up into the woods. One would remain behind, while Halkalid and the other continued on towards Oslo, bound for the safe haven of Sweden. Wind ripples the surface of Lake Tinshu. In the clear water, a slender gray fish hovers over the pebbled lake bed. It glides around the posts of the pier and up along the flat, hulking rectangle that hangs from the gleaming surface. The hull of the ferry transmits a slight, intermittent vibration into the water, the faint, polyrhythmic sound of ticking. Down in the bilge, the second hands on the two alarm clocks rotate. The minute hands circle the clock faces almost imperceptibly. The hour hand creeps towards 10. The train departs Ryukin, the freight cars carrying the heavy water bristling with heavily armed soldiers. Himmler's two planes fly overhead. The cargo arrives at the dock and rolls onto the Hydro. Standing in line at the ticket kiosk, violin case in hand, the violinist waits to board the ferry with 37 other civilian passengers. Just after 10 a.m., the SF Hydro departs. The violinist walks to the stern, looking out past the shore and up to the mountains. On the slope overlooking the lake, the one saboteur who remained behind watches as the ferry leaves the dock and recedes from sight. Its wake spreads and vanishes, the lake's surface once again calm. In a cabin just outside of Oslo the following evening, Halkalid sipped a cup of tea. A knock at the door. He opened it to find a member of the resistance, who handed him the newspaper. The front page headline read, "Railway Ferry Hydro Sunk in the Tinnisu," unquote. 14 Norwegians died, along with 4 Germans. The violinist had made it into a lifeboat and survived. All 40 drums of heavy water had sunk and were now irretrievable at the bottom of the lake. The nuclear arms race was over. The Nazis had lost. A castle rose above the Black Forest in Hagerlach in the southwestern mountains of Germany. Its red tile roof was chipped and mossy, its tower walls stained by centuries of weather. Below the castle's chapel, in a deep beer cellar cut from solid rock, Heisenberg stood over his equipment, humming softly to himself, the familiar crackling of a Geiger counter keeping time. He ran a hand through his hair and nodded to a technician who turned a winch handle. In the center of the room, a wide metal disc rose from the floor. Hanging from the disc by aircraft wire were 664 solid uranium cubes, dripping as they rose from a vat of heavy water. It was Heisenberg's latest nuclear reactor. The uranium lattice hung in the center of the cave, gleaming reflective in the gaslight, an unholy chandelier. Heisenberg ran the numbers. He was close, so close, to achieving a self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction. He just needed to scale the experiment up one more time. But to do so, he needed more heavy water. and there was no heavy water left. Worse, he'd heard rumors that he was now a wanted man. A semi-rogue American task force was coming for him, led by a maverick white Russian with an unmistakable cocksure bearing of a high school gym teacher. The jig was up. Heisenberg ordered the operation shut down. His team tore apart the lab. They sealed all sensitive documents in barrels and submerged them in a latrine. Heisenberg stuffed a backpack with uranium cubes and buried the rest in a field. He looped the backpack straps over his shoulders, hopped on a bicycle, and said farewell to his lab technicians. Flicking the kickstand up with his heel, he sped off down the road, bound for his family cabin in the nearby village. Boris Pash was hot on his trail. When Pash had become too much of a nuisance working for the Manhattan Project, what with the threatening to torture and murder scientists and all, General Groves had reassigned him to the Alsos mission in Europe. His goal, in his own words, quote, "Washington wanted absolute proof that no atomic activity of which it did not know was being carried on by the Nazis. It also wanted to be sure that no prominent German scientist would evade capture or fall into the hands of the Soviet Union," unquote. With a crack team of hand-picked men, a puppy named Alsos for a mascot, and a few jeeps and armored cars, Pash embarked on a mad dash through Italy, France, and onward into Germany. He dipped in and out of territory that was to be the Russian zone of occupation, risking diplomatic fiascos to get his hand on as much nuclear lab equipment as possible. At every opportunity, he connived his way around bureaucracy, dodged rival agents in the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA, and pissed off British intelligence. Ian Fleming, an agent in the Naval Intelligence Division and the future creator of James Bond, wrote a letter to his superiors complaining about Pash's antics. The scientists riding along with Pash described him as reckless, devil-may-care, and venturesome. In Paris, Pash ignored instructions to follow behind the French Liberation Army into the city, instead zooming out ahead up the crowd-lined streets. He was showered in bouquets, deafened by cheers. Children rode alongside his jeep on bicycles. Women ran out of the crowd to kiss him. They assumed he was their liberator. But Pash was just trying to get to the university radiation lab. In Ulin, he tracked down missing Belgian uranium. In Strasbourg, he interrogated French nuclear scientists. He rolled through bombed factories and smoldering battlefields, past burnt-out tanks and rotting corpses, occasionally even taking fire from hidden German snipers. He collected uranium in barrels of heavy water, shipping it all back to the US, far out of the reach of the Soviets, to be used in the bomb now being prepared at Los Alamos. In Hagerlach, Pash inspected the cave Heisenberg had recently abandoned. His men waded into the reeking sewage to retrieve the drums of documents. They dug up the buried uranium. After surveying Heisenberg's lab and reviewing all notes and equipment, the head scientist accompanying Pash wrote, quote, "It was so obvious the whole German uranium setup was on a ludicrously small scale." The conclusions were unmistakable. The evidence at hand proved definitely that Germany had no atom bomb and was not likely to have one in any reasonable form, unquote. Pash himself later wrote, quote, "The fact that the German atom bomb was not an immediate threat was probably the most significant single piece of military intelligence developed throughout the war," unquote. His final goal was Heisenberg. He wrote, quote, "Washington's concerns was to get Heisenberg before he was killed by disgruntled SS men or captured by the Soviets. Needless to say, the latter possibility was more disturbing," unquote. Pash selected 7 men to accompany him on a final expedition up into the Bavarian Alps, territory crawling with diehard Nazi stormtroopers. They shed their heavy packs, draped bullet-laden bandoliers over their shoulders, stuffed their pockets with K-rations, and began the climb up the snowy mountain, plunging ahead without waiting for backup. At the top of the ridge, they found Heisenberg sitting on the porch of his cabin. He invited them in and introduced Pash to his wife and children. Shortly thereafter, Pash escorted Heisenberg back out of the mountains, where the Alsos mission's scientific team waited to question him. 2 days later, Germany surrendered. The Nazi threat was neutralized. the causa belli of the American nuclear weapon program was gone. But in the eyes of the men with their fingers on the big red buttons, another formidable enemy of the American capitalist system was waiting in the wings, an adversary whose ideological tendrils were already wrapped around the hearts and minds of men in the innermost sanctum of the American nuclear weapons project. This episode of Historium was written by Thomas and produced by me, Jake Barton. It features an original track by MST, which you can listen to on its own on the Historium Patreon. For more of their music, visit mountainstandardtime.substack.com. The main sources for this episode were the books The Winter Fortress, The Epic Mission to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb by Neil Bascom, The Making of the Atomic Bomb by Richard Rhodes, and The Alsos Mission by Boris Pasch. In the next episode of Historium, Niels Bohr returns with a new plan for world peace. Oppenheimer's enemies close in from all sides as the Cold War warms up, and shadowy figures from the world of high finance work to expand the American nuclear weapons program. As always, thanks for listening.
Snow on your eyelids that courtesy with age is freezing the stairs on tyranny's wings. A bit that is hard and warmth of your skin is diseased with familiar caresses. Drawing from splendor and royal decay among all their triumphs and jaded awards. The angry and blazing circles of sun that seems as the crown prince arises. Paradise magic. Tend to answer passion and form with foreign rationalization. Primroses are the jewels that lurk among masks of pleasure that flicker with doubt. Dresses of faith that simultaneously fear to advance and demand to be recognized. The river shall flow through hollow green faces of caricatures, resentment etched out of the tongue. Bradington Sphinx is asleep before birth, the classical sensitive failure. The worshipping wicked cling to the dark of your heart, lying there in wait with your angels. Moan and ravish from dawn to dusk, the avaricious young lovers.